one of the problems in good writing is that by the time you're writing, you might know what you want to say, but the challenge of good writing is to communicate it to someone who has no idea what's in your head. So the curse of knowledge is the problem writers face of having their ideas in their head, and when they read their writing, they're filling in all the things that make sense and flow, but your reader doesn't have that. They're not inside your head. So the curse of knowledge is the problem of writing for a reader who doesn't know what you're talking about, okay, or what you're trying to get across. And so when I read my writing, I'm always trying to revise it with that in mind, because to notice where I'm making more sense of it than a reader could. Okay. So anyway, I'm excited to see the papers. I think you guys have been putting in a lot of work and gotten a lot of good discussion. Okay. We'll almost get to our work. I had this digression that I just had to do in the other class, and so I'm going to have to do it here to be parallel. But it's basically, you know this diagram here, right? So the philosophers were watching a basketball game together, and I embarrassed myself. Yeah, we get together to watch basketball. Like,
yeah, right, like Socrates and Plato.
Yeah, right. At the Parthenon, they had the hoops. Yeah, that's great. I like that. So we're there watching the game, and we have this little banter, side banter, and I said, "Wow, I'm reading this really cool book by this medical anthropologist called 100 Million Years of Food," and he makes this really interesting claim that we used to be able to process, we used to be able to make vitamin C. Whoa. Yeah, I know, isn't that cool? Yeah, like we can't do it anymore. And a lot of species lose the ability to make vitamin C, and we're one of them. So my colleagues, and this is what philosophers do, you know, they said, "Oh, well, you know, how long ago was that?" And I said, "Oh, like 63 million years ago." And they said, "Well, we weren't us then. What are you talking about?" You know, they were teasing me about it. And like, yeah, and I said, "Well," and it got worse. I was a little flustered. I was like, "Yeah, of course, I understand. You know, we've had 10,000 years of agriculture, big brains for 2 million years. So when you go back to 65 million years ago, you know," and somebody else said, "You know, well, weren't there dinosaurs around or just gone? I mean, like, what are you talking about?" So I was embarrassed. So I had to go back and kind of understand this. And so I said, I made it even worse. I said, "Oh, yeah, this is way before primates." And I was wrong again. I was getting worse. So I just like, okay. So I go back to this diagram that I like, and I was like, "Oh, gosh, okay, so he must have meant here." And so I was like, "What are haplorhines and strepsirhines, or sometimes called strepsirhines?" It's a funny name, isn't it? And so I had to read about it, and it turns out, stunning news, they were primates. Like, there were primates 65 million years ago. Now, they looked like these creatures. They didn't look like lemurs, lorises, and actually the all-cute bush baby, which we're going to have in the animal. I know. It's already, yeah. So hey, you guys want to pull up a picture of a bush baby back there? See, he's not even paying attention. Okay. So the funny detail, I'm just teasing you. You must have a bush baby on your screensaver, right? Okay, so the Strepsirhines. Oh, you got one? Yeah, they look like tarsiers, sort of. So strepsirhines are, the word literally means twisted nose, and they are the wet-nosed primates. I had no idea about this. It's just really a revelation. And the haplorhines are straight-nosed, and, you know, like rhinoceros, you see the root there. So we're dry-nosed primates. I just wanted to point that out, okay? We're the dry-nosed primates, in case you were wondering. And we can't make vitamin C, so we need to eat fruit. But the good news is there's a lot of fruit around, and it's wonderful. Okay. Sorry about that digression. I just had to share that with somebody because I was so embarrassed not to have the full account when I was watching the game. Okay. So today, let's get to our work. You gotta love primates. I mean, they were us.
We are, right?
No, we were them.
We were them. They were an F. I got that backwards. Okay. All right, let's get into our work. Here's what's going on this week in ethics. We're doing something kind of different, right? We're going to read two pretty academic articles, and that was one of the reasons I didn't do a quiz. I've not had experience where students spontaneously understand this article well. So I'm going to take you through it, and I hope I can set up a really good discussion for you to have in small group. So let's go ahead and see. So what this week we've got Christine Korsgaard today and Peter Singer on Wednesday, and they're both going to argue against Duvall. And so that's kind of interesting. Let's start our notes here. Duvall's view is has two main features for our purposes. One is that it's a naturalistic view. That is, he wants to go ahead and get that in your notes. He wants to explain ethics without appealing to anything outside of nature. Okay. And it's also a gradualist view. Right? And that means he thinks that human morality is the result of a gradual progression from, say, primate morality, right? And you have this in your notes. I won't get into a lot of detail. I just want to get it up here as a picture. And in the last time, we talked about how Duvall's theory of gradualism could, it starts with empathy as contagion. Remember that? Where everybody just gets excited and upset and starts running around and hugging each other. And then he, at the end of his story, when he's talking about the great primates, and capuchin monkeys, he's got cognitive empathy there. And so that included things like monkey fairness, which some of you sent in and posted some links on the ethics page. If you want to watch the video showing this really cool experiment, which you read about how monkeys will reject a reward if they see it as unfair. Remember that? And you came up with one of the videos, and it's on the wiki page. And then there's a TED Talk by Duvall if you want to listen to him talking about it. Great stuff. So remember also that in this picture of gradualism, we also talked about theory of mind. That is, as we work with primates that have more complex ideas of other people's intentions, then we see more developed kinds of empathy. Okay, so that's Duvall's gradualism over here, right? So one of the things we want to know is, we want to know what Korsgaard's argument against gradualism is. But before she gets to that, she gives an argument against veneer theory. So does anybody have a question? You need to stop me? Okay, feel free to interrupt. So let's start our notes here. What is Korsgaard's argument against veneer theory? And I hope if you have the text with you, if you can get it up on your screen, I'd like you to kind of follow along. I've got a couple of passages to point to, and I always want you guys to pipe up with your reading. So here's what she says. She says veneer theory isn't even coherent. So she's not saying, yeah, some people believed it, some people didn't. She's basically saying it's not worth taking seriously. That's already kind of an interesting philosophical move. I want to keep track of some of the philosophical methods here. And one thing that philosophers do is they don't always argue directly against the view that they're thinking about. Sometimes they take issue with premises, so it can be frustrating talking to a philosopher because sometimes we don't meet the view head on. Sometimes what we do is we dance around it. Yeah, that's what it sometimes looks at. Sometimes that's what we're doing. But sometimes we dig under it and we try to get it to collapse. Or we sometimes say, this is one of the most cruel criticisms, and it comes from a philosopher. I can't remember the specific philosopher, but it gets quoted in philosophical culture. Sometimes we basically say, your view isn't even wrong. It's not even wrong. It's not even good enough to be wrong. You know what I mean? It hurts, right? You don't want to hear somebody say that. The point is that philosophers often argue crossways with people. They don't, and so that's what she's doing here. She's saying, it doesn't even make sense to talk about this. To talk about the idea that humans are fundamentally self-interest maximizers. And she has some interesting reasons for saying that. So let's see if you can track this. She's saying morality morality isn't about constraining self-interest. It's about having a way of life. It's not just about doing or not doing certain things. It's also about being a certain way. And so in 101, 102, you can check this out with me. She basically says, to imagine that we're self-interest maximizers, the way veneer theory, remember, veneer theory says that except for the veneer of culture, we're all just, evolution's just made us self-interested, self-interest maximizers. We just want to flourish and get our genes, as many genes, into the next generation as possible. And she wants to say, that's not even a coherent picture of human being. We're social. So she buys into a number of naturalistic claims here. She says, no, we're natural social animals. The idea that we're self-interest maximizers, you have to imagine someone who's always calculating their interest. That's not what we do. On page 102, what we're imagining is someone who doesn't resent it when they're lied to, trampled on, disregarded. We're imagining a creature who's in deep solitude, and that's just not who we are. It's absurd to think that this is what most human beings are like. So she's given a pretty good set of reasons for not taking veneer theory seriously. The only thing I want to point out for your notes as a critical comment is it may still be true that people believe it, right? She doesn't really... She gives reasons for not taking it seriously, but remember DeWall's point isn't that it's correct, it's that this is how people thought. You see the point? So you could criticize her by saying, well, she's not taking into account that DeWall's use of veneer theory doesn't depend on people actually being right about it. It just depends on people believing it. And DeWall would agree that it's not a good characterization of us as well, right? He's a primatologist. He understands we're social animals. We're not isolated self-interest maximizers. Yeah.
You say that it's like a personal philosophy, I
want to
say.
Hey, sometimes we might call it an ideology. Veneer theory is kind of an ideology that comes out in a certain kind of Western European context where we're already on the road to libertarianism. We're already on the road to thinking about people as isolated bearers of rights. Yeah, Laura.
And veneer theory wasn't originally DeWall's, was it? Wasn't it Huxley's or something?
He's citing historical examples. Huxley's one.
Okay.
You know, scratch an altruist, what is it?
Yeah, because I...
Scratch an altruist and you find an egoist?
I can't remember.
Yeah, yes. DeWall's saying it's in the record. He's not saying it's correct. That's the point for your notes. And she's not denying that, but she's basically saying, hey, let's not even take it seriously, which is a kind of philosopher's move of just saying, well, it doesn't even matter if people believed it. It doesn't make any sense. See, you hear it? You hear the move? Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and get closer to the core argument, which is really the argument against gradualism. And that starts... here, on continuity, discontinuity of ethics with evolution. And what I want to do is reconstruct that argument with you and make sure we're clear about it. And then we're going to get in groups and evaluate it, okay? Again, she has some interesting observations to make right at the beginning that are relevant to her argument. So you should make a couple of notes here. By the way, I should have mentioned, she's a Kantian, right? And at some point she's gonna show her color there, because she's a really good philosopher and she's a really good Kantian. But here's a kind of belief that Kantians would normally have. She says, there's a deep discontinuity between humans and nature. And this is something we haven't seen in the course yet, somebody representing this view. She said, yeah, maybe we're more like apes than people think. And she goes into why that might be. You know, we treat animals terribly, and maybe we don't want to think of ourselves as animals because of all the testing we do on them and how we eat. So we eat 27 billion animals a year. Isn't that amazing? It's a lot of animals. So maybe we don't want to think of ourselves like animals. Fair enough. But we're also not really like other animals. We're damaged. Very interesting thing she says here. It's almost as if the humans had some break with nature. Any connections with that idea? It's a pretty interesting idea. How, what would you point to defend that? It's almost like we're...
Agricultural revolution.
I don't know. The first thing I thought was, like, Adam and Eve and like, sort of the Christian roots of a lot of, like, Western society and fall from grace.
No, the Eden myth is a good example. I mean, the Eden myth is a myth about the loss of continuity with nature, right? By the way, in philosophy of food, we teach it as a movement from hunter-gatherers to agriculture, because after all, you know, in Eden, the food's just there, you just have to pick it, and then you just obey, and then you have to work, you have to toil. So yeah, that's a good example. Other examples, you were thinking of cultural revolutions, that's a good example.
Agricultural?
Yeah. And then after agriculture, it seems like we suddenly captured enough energy from our environment that we had room for priests and philosophers and craftsmen, and we're off to the races, right? So a lot of people would say human beings kind of departed from the nature script with agriculture, because prior to agriculture, you just don't have that much standing culture. People move around a lot. Okay, so that's kind of what she has in mind. And so she's setting the stage with that. That's really not part of the argument. Okay, here's where the argument starts. DeWall is making a typical mistake people make by overreading intentions from behavior. Let's get that in our notes. DeWall is mistaking behaviors for intentions, overreading behaviors as intentional. And I'll give you an example right away.
When you say that, do you mean like some mistaking instinct for someone willingly deciding to do that? It's like,
yeah, we know that animals have instincts, but we tend to credit them with intentions like ours. You know, think about the way people overread their pets' behaviors, right? I mean, a lot of people think their pets are just geniuses, you know. And I have a good story. I didn't talk to tell this story, but in the last class it came to mind. And it was, again, another story, two stories tonight about philosophers watching basketball. Can you imagine? So we were watching basketball a couple weeks ago, and my friend and his wife have a new German Shepherd, beautiful dog. And I was sitting there, and I had a very small glass of beer with me. And so at one point I put it on the floor, and the dog came and started drinking my beer. So then 2 weeks later, this is the last game Saturday, I'm sitting there, and my host says, I think Maya, the dog, I think she has a crush on you. Notice she's ascribing an intention. Absolutely. Yeah, it's just a joke, right? She doesn't really believe it. And I said, no, dogs hate me. And so it can't be that. And so what turns out that Maya was watching me because, again, at some point I put my beer on the floor, and she did it again. So what are you inclined to do? You're inclined to think, Maya remembered, this is the guy who makes his beer available to me from 2 weeks ago. No, probably not. I mean, I don't know for sure. You know, dogs are smart. But does Maya have a memory from 2 weeks ago about me? You think maybe?
Smell? Dogs can smell.
But, so she's just smelling beer. But isn't that simpler? Maya's smelling beer.
No,
she likes beer.
Smell you. You smell distinctive.
No, but you're overcomplicating it. Couldn't it just be that she smells beer? She does. Okay. So this is the problem. Okay, the problem is when are we warranted? This is good for you to know. When are we warranted in ascribing intentions to an animal's behavior? And Korsgaard's pretty sure that DeWall is doing this too much. He's been spending too much time with primates, and he is not separating enough what the behavior is actually warranting. So what her argument is going to be is to say, well, look, let's do an analysis of intentionality. When is it okay to ascribe intentions to people, to behave to animals? Okay, so she starts with stage one, and I think we got about four stages here. This is the argument, so let's track it. Stage one would just be any functional system. So a fun example for philosophers would be a thermostat. I don't think she uses that example, but philosophers actually do debate sometimes what thermostats know and when do they know it. I know, isn't that weird? Right? So does it make sense to say that your thermostat believes it's too hot in the room when it makes the air conditioner come on? No. The thermostats do not have intentional states. Let's make sure that's in your notes, right? But some philosophers have argued for that. I know, we're not even going to go into that. The thermostats have no beliefs. They're just thermostats. They're functional systems, they have purposes, they fulfill their purposes, they act, they change things. And that's it. So that's stage one. And this, by the way, this is the dominant method here. We call it analysis. It's breaking down a concept. In this case, the concept is intentionality. It's breaking it down because she suspects the mistake that Dual made was to use the concept inappropriately. Can you see that? So this is not all philosophers argue this way, but this is a purely conceptual argument. She's saying, look, if we understand intentionality right, we won't talk like Dual does, and that's the mistake he's making. Okay, so step one, no intentionality, functional system, there's purpose, there's action, there's causation, but no intentionality, okay? So let's go on to the next stage. So stage two would be a perceptual animal is acting in the world and moves toward certain goals like food, sex, safety, predation, but this animal has nothing in its head. It's just acting according to instinct, right? So we've got perceptual animals who are just, and the phrase that she uses is nothing before their minds. And what she means is they don't have a representation in their heads of what they're doing. They just do it. Does that make sense? Is it plausible to say that at least some animals are probably simple enough to where there's nothing going on in the head? It's just automatic.
So it's like they don't think twice about attacking another animal unless it's for like safety reasons.
Yeah, or but they're still not thinking twice then. It's just like, oh, better go, you know, or oh, better not get in a fight with this animal. It's they're not thinking, hey, there's some food. Oh, hey, there's a mate. Wow, what, you know, they're not doing
Wasn't
that.
Wasn't that the example of the spider?
Yeah, remind us of that.
Web.
That's good.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, remind us. I forgot that one. Yeah, tell me, where do you remember where it is?
It was somewhere around the meeting, I think, but it was just about, like, the spider doesn't, like, think before it goes to,
good.
Like, it's not even thinking about, like, it's
good.
Just within its nature, basically, to it, if something falls into its web.
Right,
like,
the spider crawls toward the moth that's caught in the web.
Yeah.
The cockroach runs under as you swat him. The cockroach isn't saying, you know, oh, there's that human again.
Yeah.
You know, that's just not what's happening, probably. Okay, yeah, good. Other examples? Good. So stage three, now we're dealing with more sophisticated animals, right? Now we've got animals who have purposes, and they can entertain thoughts about how to achieve them. So this is animal behavior. With complex strategies, right? So these are strategies for choosing means to ends, right? And they might have these strategies before their minds in some sense. They might appear to be entertaining thoughts about the best way to achieve them. You can certainly, she would allow the primates do this. When we watch primates using tools to get food out of a rock or some other, or out of a seed or a nut, you know, we seem to be watching people, we're watching animals that have some cognitions going on, right? There's more agency here. They're right? And then here's where the gradualism stops. She wants to say that between 3 and 4, there's a huge leap. And no other animal does anything like this. She's got a strong point to make there. So her argument against Duvall's gradualism is at its heart, it's an argument that this is where the gradual changes stop. Now, what is that dramatic change? Well, it's the idea that what we do is ask about not just means, but we ask about ends. We don't just have ideas in our heads about how to achieve ends that nature gave us. We ask this kind of question: is wanting this a good reason for pursuing it? Is wanting X, this, whatever you're talking about, a good reason for pursuing it? And she thinks that's an important question that requires you to not only have the goal and the means in front of you, but to be able to choose the goal to not choose it, right? So remember her example? Anybody remember the example of the king who wants the guy to bear false witness under penalty of being killed? Yeah, why does she think that's so important? Because the guy, yeah, good.
Well, I think the big thing there was, there wasn't a clear path, with the other, lesser animals, I guess. It was, it ate and eat, and there's one way to get there. But here it's, you could go from A to B, or you'd go another way, and not everything is, as apparent as...
Yeah, you could reject... You don't have to respond to the king from self-interest. You can say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm operating with an ideal that I've chosen. It's an ideal. You can imagine a Kantian saying, this is a Kantian kind of example, right? Where you remember in Kant, you go against all your inclinations have nothing to do with morality in Kant. You remember that? It's all about the maxim that you, whether you can universalize the maxim, and promoting the idea of rationality. So the point is that we're the creatures that can ask, is wanting this a good reason for pursuing it? We're the creatures who require justification. We choose ideals. We choose ends and ideals. We don't just choose means. And we can choose ideals regardless of whether they promote our self-interest or not. Doesn't have to happen. We can be heroes, right? We can be moral heroes for an ideal that we chose. It could be an ideal of liberating our country. It could be an ideal of anything. So humans have this kind of freedom and independence from nature in a way, because the key thing in stage 3 was that all the goals were given to you by nature and you couldn't really change that. And what humans can do is go, takes us way beyond that. Okay. Just questions about the core argument, please.
So I know that the fourth argument talks a little bit about how we're autonomous. So why is the agency of the animals in the third stage
Good.
Not autonomous?
Good. Because remember we glossed autonomy as to be autonomous, right? To be self-legislating. So autonomy requires you to have chosen the ends that you act on. That's a very good question. And that's what she's claiming animals at stage 3 can't do.
So just to clarify,
sure.
the kind of gaping gap.
Yes, right.
That's quite to see if there was a term for that within the reading. But she's not saying that it's not gradual because it didn't occur gradually, but because it's not gradual right now between species. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if I'm hearing you right. I mean, she's saying it's not gradual because something happened to us. And it might be when we got big brains, over the last 2 million years, right? Our brain size tripled. It's just amazing. We're up to a 1,400 cc brain. it's getting hard to give birth naturally. That's how big the brains are getting, right? So it could be, seriously, I mean, that's an issue. So she's not denying that there could be a natural series of causes that led to this, but once that happened, maybe you think it happened with agriculture, we said that, you know, we were just off to the races. Oh my God, we're not part of nature anymore in an important sense.
So within the grand scheme of things that happened,
yeah,
way less gradually than the rest. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if it's from when we were 400 cc brains to 1400, even if that took 2 million years, in the context of 100 million years of evolution, right, from when we were tarsiers and stuff, you know, that's still pretty sudden. Right?
And you call that gap a discontinuity?
Yeah, that's what she's saying. And she's got, I mean, she's got some insight here. I mean, I think she's right. Can we just assess her claim here at this level? Do you think she's right to say that human cognition gives us capability of choosing ends and that that allows a kind of morality that has nothing to do with primates? Primates can just work with these emotions in relation to predetermined goals that are given by nature. They're instinctual goals. They never sit around and make art. Well, there's actually been some primates that that's not what it was. Yeah, they don't build cathedrals. They don't sit around and ask, well, what if we lived a totally different way than this? Let's be communist. Let's be capitalist. It's just, I mean, she's right. There's something really powerful there. The hard question. So now I hope I got you sympathetic to Dewall. Were you guys liking Dewall? Wasn't the monk, like things like the monkey fairness research? That's pretty cool stuff, right? But notice what she's trying to say is when she goes back to that. I should have included this. She's skeptical. She says maybe the Capuchin isn't protesting unfairness. Maybe the Capuchin is just trying to get a grape. Maybe this is just a behavior the Capuchin monkey thinks will get him or her a grape. Maybe the dog isn't remembering me from 2 weeks ago. Maybe the dog is just smelling beer again. And all the beer is kind of protected, except the goofy guy here who's got his beer on the floor for the second time in a row. Sucker. You know, it's not like the dog's having all these complex thoughts. It's just, I kind of like beer. Sort of like you guys. I don't know. No, I'm sorry. I'm teasing. Are you seeing it? Are you seeing the argument? It's not just a matter of degree. She calls it a salt. This is a weird term. It's a nice word, actually. We don't use it. Saltatory. It's something that a small change that changes everything. So it's almost like people talk about the Neolithic, the agricultural period as a revolution. Okay. So now here's the hard questions. Now hopefully we remember what Dewall's gradualism looks like. We now have a picture of her argument against it. Is it successful? Is she really undermining Dewall's gradualism? And I don't want you to just say, oh yeah, of course, it's a good argument. She's definitely criticizing it. What I'd like you to do is, what I'd like you to do in your group, and I think this might help generate some insights, is I'd like you to start by seeing if you can agree about what Korsgaard's insights are, what her strongest points are, where she seems to be dead right. But then I also want you to make a list, and again, I think I like continua, so, and we'll call this list the range of implications for gradualism. And at one end of the continuum, we'll say, you know, wow, she hit a home run. Gradualism is dead, right? At the other end, hey, maybe she's still got some maybe she's right about a lot of things, but maybe those insights are compatible with some version of Dewall's gradualism. You see the range here? So the range here is gradualism is dead, and something like compatibilism, like there's something compatible between her insights and Dewall's. And that's a way of saying, well, she didn't really kill Dewall's art view, she just modified it. Okay? So what I'd like you to do is those two exercises as a way of coming to your own view about whether Korsgaard is successful in arguing against gradual. And generate a list of insights that you think you agree she has, and then try to figure out what the range of positions here is. Does that make sense? What's the impact of her argument on Duvall's theory? Okay, can we do that in groups? We need about 10 minutes for this, so stay on task, try to develop a view of this, and make sure you catch up with each other in the process, okay? Hurt them, I don't think. And they're in retirement. It's beautiful. And you can go to a symposium. And they give the chimps magazines, and the chimps have learned sign language. They learn about, the smartest one I think had about 300 words, very limited syntax. And there were instances of the mom chimp teaching sign language to a baby, which is pretty darn cool. It doesn't happen in nature. But these are pretty special chimps, right? So it's kind of like a trained dog, if you buy Korsgaard's theory. If you're more inclined toward Duvall's way of looking at it, it's like, they can do some of this. I mean, they're not signing each other like, do you believe in human rights? No, really, literally, they give them food magazines, and they sign things like, look at these strawberries. No, seriously, it's really cool. And if they come up to the window, and they'll, like when we were there, this was years ago, but it's still very vivid, they'll say, they'll kind of point to your shoe and kind of sign, take your shoes off. It's like, weird, I can't see your feet. This is disturbing. So like, they've definitely got ideas about how things ought to be. Like, oh, okay, one more chimp detail. This is just the best. I think this is true. I think this was reported so there are people who still do some research on them. There was a case when they let the chimps out of their enclosure in the winter, but they don't always do it if it's really cold. And the chimp actually on this occasion signed, give us our coats. Like they weren't being let out. And the chimp kind of signed, you know, to the coats and like, hey, you know, we got coats. So that's pretty cool, you know. I mean, aren't you rooting for the chimps? Aren't you hoping they'll just bust out a crazy idea like you know, I don't like Lady Gaga or something like that? Yeah. So I mean, you're right to suspect that there are animals. There might be animal research which suggests that she's not giving them full credit, you know. But it's not robust. I mean, they're not making up new sentences a lot. They're not going beyond a couple hundred signs, you know. So it's great. But, yeah, if you're ever in Ellensburg, you have to see when they offer these. Because they don't want to put the chimps on display like a zoo, which is very cool. Okay, so let's see. Insights, I think we covered. Let's get this range out, because I do think this might be useful for your notes. I want to see if your discussion kind of, where your discussions might have plugged in. So at one level, at the most extreme level, you could say, wow, Korsgaard did it, gradualism's dead. This is where human morality happens, right? So you see how you have to commit to that to get to this end of the continuum. Next step down, okay, gradualism's true, but once agriculture comes in, I guess it's less true or not relevant. So gradualism made sense up to a point, but it can't really tell us about human morality, okay? A weaker implication, right? Range of implications, right? Both and. I mean, Korsgaard says it's an either or. You know, either you got empathy systems, emotive systems for regulating social groups, or you've got like these really fancy intentions. Intention is something new on this view, but emotions are still there. They're still doing work, right? So you can believe that. You can believe Korsgaard's right about everything she says, except it's not an either-or, it's a both-and. And in philosophy, you should always, and in life, you should always be suspicious when somebody says, it's not this, rather it's this. It's kind of a diversion of attention. Very often, it's both, right? And then the weakest implication would be that, you know, all these fancy intentions that she thinks mark us off as totally different kinds of creatures, a totally different kind of morality, things like human rights and believing in human dignity, you know, choosing to tell the king to, forget it, you're going to go ahead and choose death rather than something ignoble. All those fancy intentions are still serving natural imperatives. So the reason we show that we are not sexist, homophobic, against rights is because we want to be perceived a certain way by our group. And we want to be thought of as a good member of our group. So, you know, we're still, the natural imperatives are still there. It's just that we're meeting them with designer jeans and crazy political ideas, you know? So, yeah, chimps aren't making up fashion. But there is a little bit of primate culture. There is a little literature on primate culture, by the way. I mean, now the consensus would be that primates have some forms of culture because they do teach, they pass things along and stuff. But it's, again, it's like language, it's limited. So do you see that range of implications? So being impressed with Dwal and being impressed with Haidt and being impressed with Korsgaard, you can be impressed with all of them, because in philosophy you still have to sort out sort of what's the implication of the argument. It's never like one person's absolutely wrong and then one person's absolutely right. It's rarely like that. Does that make sense? What do you think? Thoughts from your small group work that might intersect with this, or assessments of where you are now with this view? We're going to get another set of objections on Wednesday from Singer. So we'll be doing this again that way. The only thing I'd add, if I could, I'm just throwing this out there. I don't have readings on it, but it's a really hot area in psychology and philosophy. Let me preface it. Korsgaard is making it sound like to have intentions is to have something in your head that you can represent symbolically. And some people think that that's a cognitive bias, that isn't always what's happening. And so some of these theorists are called embodied cognition or extended cognition theorists, and their hypothesis is intentions don't always have to be in the head. That's kind of a strange idea, right? I'm not going to spend too much time on it tonight. We're kind of at the end of our class, but I just want to kind of throw it out there and see if I can explain it. Intentions don't always have to be in our head. You can look at environmental psychologists, for instance, look at how environments affect people's behavior. We started the course, right, with that Ariely research on cheating, right, and lying. Notice that in that case, it's the environment, the way the matrix test was set up, that sometimes triggers moral and immoral behavior, right? So that might be a good article, although that comes out of a behavioral economics literature, not this. But it's compatible with what extended cognition and embodied cognition theorists are doing, which is to say, you know, we use our environment to structure our intentions. So a speaker who was here from the Netherlands who does this kind of stuff said, hey, you know, artifacts are moral. Some of you went to this talk, right? Like a turnstile embodies a moral rule. Don't cheat on the subway, right? So we can use, so the idea is that intentions aren't necessarily representations in the head. They can be, then humans are very sophisticated about that. But they could also be in the environment, by the way we structure environments. And that would undermine some of the specialness of step four, because now step four looks a little bit like, oh, that's the special case of intentions when they're in your head and you can represent them symbolically. I mean, it could be that the chimps at Central Washington are capable of experiencing kinds of intentions because of their training, even though they can't do this kind of thing, right? So they understand there's coats, there's cold air, there's people controlling their access to the outside. That's all embedded in the context. Does that make sense? It's kind of a hard idea. And so that's a way of saying that philosophers have had a bias toward consciousness, that we've been thinking, well, what's really special about us is what's going on in our heads. But lots of evidence from different fields like environmental psychology and anthropologists maybe suggesting that it's not always like that. And maybe maybe primates, well, okay, so you could see where that could go. You could blur the line a little bit here. Okay? What's the score of the game? Anybody happen to know? Didn't they, haven't they been playing for a while? Could somebody look it up, please? How good of you not to to resist the temptation, all.
34-24.
Oh, that's good news. Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. Let's stop there, guys. Thanks for your attention, especially on a potentially distracting night.